border. Again and again, he trudged back to the Somali side of the border where we waited for him and told us, maybe tomorrow. There were simply too many of us, and the prices were too high. All the Somalis, who still had money as we did, were also bribing the police and offering huge sums to anyone who would drive them closer to Nairobi. Finally, Mahmoud told us he had made a deal. He had found a bus driver who would take us, but he had agreed to pay him almost all our remaining money. The bus took us to a place in the foothills of Garissa, where we spent the night. Then we took another bus to Garissa, and yet another one to Nairobi. By this time, the children were no longer even crying. They were almost motionless. We walked into my mother's house at 10:30 in the morning at the end of February 1991. I had been gone for 3 weeks. She had been so desperate about us. She, too, looked thin and haggard. She was stunned to see me walking, filthy and crawling with lice, with a huge crowd of starving people. We ate and drank clean water. Then, before we even washed, I put Marianne in a taxi with me and told the driver to go to Nairobi Hospital. We had no money left, and I knew Nairobi Hospital was expensive. It was where I had been operated on when the Maalim broke my skull. But I also knew that there they would help us first and ask us to pay later. Saving the baby's life had become the only thing that mattered to me. At the reception desk, I announced, "This baby is going to die," and the nurse's eyes went wide with horror. She took him and put a drip in his arm, and very slowly, this tiny shape seemed to uncrumple slightly. After a little while, his eyes opened. The nurse said, "The child will live," and told us to deal with the bill at the cash desk. I asked her who her director was and found him, and told this middle-aged Indian doctor the whole story. I said I couldn't pay the bill. He took it and tore it up. He said it didn't matter. Then he told me how to look after the baby and where to get rehydration salts, and we took a taxi home. Ma paid for the taxi and looked at me, her eyes round with respect. "Well done," she said. It was a rare compliment. In the next few days, the baby began filling out, growing from a crumbled horror movie image into a real baby, watchful, alive. One evening at dinner, I said, "Now, we must give this baby a name. He must have been about 6 weeks old by then." Just as I said that, there was a knock at the door, and yet another refugee arrived. The 18-year-old younger brother of Osman and Mahmoud and Mohammed. His name was Abbas Abdihalin. "Let him be named after me, after the great Abbas," he crowed. So the child was named Abbas. He must be a teenager now. Little Abbas was everyone's favorite. A child with no father and no future, a child who could so easily have died, but for the grace of Allah, he was a gem, winning and lively, cooed over and protected by us all. The house was full and everyone was jubilant just to be alive. The two cousins I had brought with me became my mother's children. She was gentle with them and cooked separate meals for them. Ma was oddly happy for a while with this huge tribe around her. Ramadan came, the time of families, and our flat was like a clan meeting of the Osman Mahmoud. People began sending us money from abroad. Somalis living all over the world, in Canada, in Europe, sent us money by hawala. The hawala system is a fine example of Somali ingenuity. You go to see a man in Toronto or Stockholm or Kuala Lumpur. You give him cash. He calls a grocery store in a Somali neighborhood in Nairobi or Birmingham or anywhere else and arranges for your friend to pick up the money. There is a commission, but no paperwork. The whole thing takes a few phone calls and just a day or two. It's based entirely on trust within the clan or within the Muslim Brotherhood, which runs the cheapest and most reliable systems of all. The same thing was happening for Somali families sheltering refugees all over Kenya. Money was coming in from the clans. But even though we had enough money for food, the apartment was still a madhouse. The noise alone was insane. Order was barely maintained by the men leaving the house all day. The scabies and lice drove us mad too, scabies especially. We bought crates of lotion at a time at the clinic, but the lotion only works if everybody uses it at the same time and washes everything. In our apartment, people always forgot or just didn't bother, and more people were constantly arriving. At one point, there must have been 35 or 40 of us. We were constantly reinfested. It was like a plague. One afternoon, Mahat came home with two Hawiya men he had known in Mogadishu, friends of his who had nowhere to go. He couldn't leave them on the street in Nairobi. But our flat was full of Darod, full to bursting of Darod men who cursed the Hawiya butchers from day into night. Mahat walked into the house, stood straight in the doorway, and introduced these two men. He explained that they had nowhere to go and nothing to reproach themselves for, and told everyone, "We are not going to say anything negative about the Hawiya." Everyone was frozen with shock, but obeyed. They stayed a week. One morning in March, I received a letter in English from a woman in Finland. She said she was in love with Mahmoud Muhammad Artan and enclosed a picture of herself with him. He was standing, tall and handsome in a white shirt, with his arm around a white blonde woman against a backdrop of blue sea. The Finnish girl wrote that Mahmoud had a framed photograph of the two of us, but he had told her that I was his cousin. Was I really just his cousin? The letter asked me, because this Finnish girl planned to marry Mahmoud. It was like a gift. I had almost forgotten about Mahmoud, and now this Finnish woman was proposing to take him off my hands. I wrote a polite reply. Of course I was Mahmoud's cousin, I wrote, and of course I couldn't possibly be his wife. That would be incest. If he was implying that we might in any way be married, this was just teasing. Then I folded up her letter and the photograph, feeling like such an adult for solving my personal problems so neatly. Chapter 9, Abe. In April 1991, my father came to Nairobi. The Abdi Halim brothers bust in with the news one night after the Ramadan dinner. They told us they had been at the house of Farah Gure and that they had heard that our father was in Nairobi. I jumped up screaming with excitement and began dancing for joy all over the place. Hawiya was happy too. Mahat was a bit quiet, and Ma had a look on her face that seemed to marvel at how forgiving we were. I told her, "Ma, I'm going to look for Abe and bring him home." She said nothing of the sort. "He can't stay here." But I told her, "We'll talk about that later," completely dismissing her emotions on the subject. She didn't make a scene about it because she couldn't. A mother is not permitted to separate children from their father. We belong to him. Hawiya and I wrapped ourselves up in shawls and walked to Farah Gure's house, which was also flooded with refugees, with people sleeping on every floor. We went from room to room until we found Fadumo and asked, "Where is Abe?" She began smiling as if the sun had come out. He was in Nairobi, she told us. Everybody was at the mosque right then performing the Taraweeh. They would be home later. Fadumo had tears in her eyes. She was so happy for us, but she said we had to understand that everybody was waiting to spend time with our father. He had arrived yesterday, and all these people had been waiting to see him. Still, we had a right to him. The most important right. We sat and waited until almost midnight, when the doorway suddenly filled up with the shape of my father. We rushed and jumped at him, just as we had when he had arrived years before in Mecca, even though we were now easily twice as tall. We took him down to the floor, and he was laughing and shouting, my daughters, my children," and hugging us. He looked at us and said, "You're grown women now, but you still look exactly the same." There was so much affection in his eyes. Fadumo invited us to sit in the living room, but we wanted to take our father home with us. Abe stood up, smiled at her and said, "There is a time to go and a time to stay, and this is not the time to stay." His hair was grayer, he was older, but he was still exactly the same person. He even smelled the same. I put my head in his neck and kept smelling him until he removed his shawl and gave it to me. We were gleeful, and everyone around us was beaming. Among all the murder and mayhem and refugees and diseases and loss, there was this joy. They were so happy for us. They said, "Go with the children." So we tugged Abe out of the house, and someone drove us home. There in the dark, in the street in front of the house, stood Ma and Mahat. I realized Ma had not wanted to greet our father in front of everyone. She had been waiting for us on the sidewalk for hours. My father got out of the car and opened his arms wide and said, "Ah, Asha," in a clear voice. She turned her face away and said, "No." My father embraced her anyway, but she was still called rejection. Then Mahat hugged my father. It was a quiet kind of greeting, and he put his arms around our mother and took her into the house. Hawea and I followed with Abe, and when they saw him, everyone in the house began shouting and greeting and telling stories. Ma stayed in the kitchen. The first night he was there, Abe slept in the living room with all the men. At 5:30 next morning, he woke up, turned on all the lights, and began singing the call to prayer. "Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar," like at the mosque. All the young men on the floor were startled awake, and they all more or less abashedly stood up and began to wash, to prepare themselves. In our bedroom, Ma woke us up saying, "Your father is calling to pray." The whole house started praying. Ma wondered loudly if people were praying to please Allah or Abe, as few of these people had shown evidence of praying before his arrival. Mahat Hawea and I giggled at her apt analysis, but still, there was something very beautiful there for a moment. Everyone was tired, but everyone felt it. Nothing seemed to make my ma more tender toward Abe. Every morning he greeted her, "Asha, how are you this morning?" And every morning she turned away. She never once spoke to our father or looked him in the face for the 6 months he lived with us. Yet she would wake me early every morning and insist I make a separate breakfast for my father, much better than everyone else's. And every night before bed, she would set aside his plate, his glass, his fork, spoon and knife, so that in this cramped kitchen there was one shelf that held the crockery and pans preserved for my father. I admired my mother's sensitivity to the code of honor and her dignity, but I didn't like the way she ignored Abe, though I could see why she did it. She had been neglected, left alone to bring up his children and beg his family for money. She felt that she was no longer his wife, so she fed him. She insisted that everyone in the house respect his privacy and his need for peace. She observed all the proper behavior, but she extricated herself from the situation, went cold, and disappeared. I cleaned out the pantry for Abe to stay in, a small room with a very small high window. He slept there on a mattress on the floor, with his clothes in a little pile on a cowhide stool, his copy of the Quran and a naked light bulb to read by. When Abe was home, there was a sense of order in our household. People were more dignified. They sat up straighter and listened. He did the talking. Before he was around, the young men had spent whole afternoons chewing khat and playing cards. They were careful to throw away the evidence before Ma walked in, but they did it. Now our flat was like a madrasa. It was clean. The men began folding their clothes and removing their shoes in the doorway. Bedtime changed drastically. We went to bed early and got up early, and we prayed. Abe was out most of the day at the mosque, meeting with elders, various people from the clans, trying to sew things together to come to some sort of peaceful arrangement. He was still completely caught up in his vision of a unified, ideal Somalia, but he now believed that only Islam could bind the warring clans together. The kind of violence that had been unleashed across the country could be pacified only by the rule of Allah. My father had given up on American-style democracy. Abe told me about his little daughter in Addis Ababa. Her name was Marian. She didn't speak Somali yet, but he would teach her. His new wife spoke only Amharic. We didn't talk about her much. Speaking about a concert with the children of another wife is impolite. But Abe sounded so tender when he spoke about their little girl. I forgave him. Ramadan ended, and people began to realize they couldn't all stay in our apartment forever. I started trampling down through East Lee with one or another of the men, trying to track down landlords and find places to rent. Quite quickly, Mahmoud found an apartment for his family, Mohammed's family, and Marian and her children. Some of the other young men moved into a long-stay hotel on Ngara Road. Still, there were a lot of us. My life became devoted to the management of the various problems of our suddenly expanded family. Finding new flats, getting the utilities turned on, arranging money transfers, translating everything. I did the housework, which Ma considered my responsibility as the elder daughter, took children to the doctor, and went to the electricity company to pay the bill. I helped register people for resettlement programs in foreign countries, which were taking educated refugees from Somalia. I rushed to get them to the Somali embassy to get proper passports before the entire state apparatus of Somalia collapsed and all Somali diplomacy closed down, stranding them for who knows how long. After several weeks, more young men arrived, friends of Mahat's. The more men there are, the less help women have around the house. And when Mahmoud left, he took away all the women who had been helping me with the housework. Now I was alone to do it all, and I protested. I told Ma that we must hire a maid, a Kenyan girl, to wash the clothes and keep the house clean. Under these circumstances, this would not be a luxury. Ma said no. I defied her and said, "If you don't want a maid, you will have to do it yourself." I went to my father and said I needed 300 shillings a month for a maid. We had money now that Abe was here. He paid the rent. He was glad to pay for a maid to help me. But after a few weeks, Ma chased the girl away. She said having a maid was against her principles. I told her I couldn't do all the work myself, all the washing by hand and scrubbing and cooking. She never helped with it. But now I refused to wash any clothes, and she beat me with a rolling pin for insolence. Ma was depressed and becoming bitter and unreasonable again, closing in on herself and hitting me more often. She was unwelcoming. People were moving out of our house because of her. She felt everything was going wrong in her life, while in the wider world, people were slaughtering each other like animals. After returning to Nairobi, I didn't resume going to the Islamic youth debates, and I avoided Sister Aziza. The idea that somehow everything would fall into place when the House of Islam was completed, that a beautiful caliphate would rise up in which everyone would be compassionate, helpful, and live according to the rules, where everything would work right, seemed almost fatuous. When my father had us pray, I simply went through the motions, thinking about breakfast, about my chores, and about the day that lay ahead. A few months later, Marian Farah, my father's first wife, arrived from Mogadishu with Arro and Ijabo. Marian didn't come live with us. That would have been too much to ask. She had some relatives in East Lee and at first moved there with the girls. But this East Lee family was far too sinful for Ijabo. She didn't want to live with people who chewed qat and watched Western movies. So although Arro stayed in East Lee, Ijabo moved in with us to be with Abe. He was her father too. Ijabo's stories about Mogadishu were horrific. She had watched dogs eating bodies on the street, and the stench of the corpses had been horrible. Ijabo was alive only because her grandmother, Marian's mother, had been from a Hawiya family of the same lineage as the forces that besieged Mogadishu. Marian, although a Darod, was not snobbish and had always treated her Hawiya relatives with respect. When the collapse came, the Hawiya side of their family kept Marian's house safe, even though the rest of the neighborhood was bathed in blood. When Marian and the girls finally left Mogadishu, The city was more than half empty. Only the weakest and the Hawiya were left. It had become a place of unpredictable murder, Ichabo told us. There was no authority. No one could enforce any kind of order. My stepsister was thinner now and even more devout. In a way, I could understand this. For Ichabo, death had become very real. Any one of us could die at any moment, and it was urgent to prepare to face God. But this also meant that Ichabo behaved like some kind of robot, constantly hectoring everyone to be more observant. After a few weeks, it irritated us all. More than once, Hawea snarled at her to stop it. Ichabo would always wail in her teeny, high-pitched voice, "I'm your sister, and I love you so much, and I'm not telling you to pray to bother you, but because I want you to go to heaven. Allah said, verse this, verse that, remember those who do not pray, they shall be charcoal for the fire." One afternoon, just after Ichabo settled into our apartment, a young woman, Fauzia, knocked at our door, looking for Abdullahi Yasin. She told him she had nowhere to go. Fauzia had her 3-year-old boy with her. The child was the son of someone Abdullahi knew, an Osman Mahmud, but he was Gara, a bastard, born out of wedlock. Fauzia was alone, and she begged Abdullahi to ask if she could stay in our house. Abdullahi Yasin was embarrassed, but he came and told Ma and me the story. Ma got a look on her face like something smelled bad. She couldn't have a prostitute in the house, she said. I recoiled. There was nothing at all to indicate that Fauzia was a prostitute. I saw in front of me the image of the woman in the rag hat in the camp. I said to Ma, "If you don't let her stay, I'm leaving." It was a long struggle, but Mahat and Hawea backed me, and we won. Finally, Ma said, "She can stay, but I don't want to see her." I found a clean sheet and a towel. Those were the rarest things in our household. And this poor woman ended up staying with us for a few months with her little boy. By that time, there were so many of us that Hawea, Ichabo, and I had to share a mattress. To Ichabo, Fauzia was the living face of shame, and she immediately embarked on a program to persuade her to repent her sinful ways and become a member of the Brotherhood. Ichabo used to say, "The only way to wash off your shame is to pray, pray, and pray, and give your life to Allah in search of forgiveness." One evening, when she was getting at Fauzia again, I snapped and told her to shut up. She was utterly irritating. I said Allah wouldn't test us on whether we condemned somebody who became pregnant outside of marriage. He would test us on our hospitality and charity. Ichabo quoted the Quran for the 600th time that day. "The man and the woman who commit adultery, flog each one of them 100 times, she said. I told her, "Okay, here is a stick. Since we don't have Islamic law in Kenya, do you want to do the flogging?" Abe, who was in the room at the time, laughed and took my side. Ichabo acted angry and insulted for weeks. Mahat and Hawea knew I was Abe's favorite, but they had also learned long ago not to complain about it. Jealousy is forbidden. The Somalis all shunned Fauzia. When we went out to do the shopping, she was constantly molested on the street. Men would grab at her breast and stare at her lasciviously. They would never have dared to look at me that way. I was Hersimagan's daughter. But Fauzia was known to all as a harlot, and she had no clan protector. She was prey. Fauzia was used to the verbal and physical abuse. She was conditioned to believe that she deserved it. She told me to ignore Ichabo's remarks. Unlike Ichabo, Fauzia used to help me with the cooking, cleaning, and shopping. After the early morning prayer, she didn't go back to bed like everyone else did, but instead helped me bake angelos for everyone's breakfast. Fauzia told me clearly that she lived for only one thing, her son. He was prey too. The other, bigger children treated the boy as an outcast. Aidarus and Ahmed, my young cousins, used to plague him. My family never stepped in to prevent the abuse. There was a stigma on him. It was the first time I had knowingly met the child of an unmarried woman. Most unmarried Somali girls who got pregnant committed suicide. I knew of one girl in Mogadishu who poured a can of gasoline over herself in the living room with everyone there and burned herself alive. Of course, if she hadn't done this, her father and brothers would probably have killed her anyway. A letter arrived from Switzerland for Mohammed Abdihalin's wife, Fadumo. Her sister, who was living in Europe, had managed to prepare all the papers to get Fadumo and her children a visa to Switzerland. We had only to go to the Swiss embassy to pick up the visa and buy the tickets. The plan was this. Fadumo would travel to Europe with the children. But instead of going to Switzerland, which almost never gave refugee status to Somalis, she would stop over in Holland. Once she was at the Amsterdam airport, Fadumo would tear up her ticket and ask for asylum in the Netherlands, where it was much easier to qualify as a refugee and then live there, receiving money from the state. Mohammed stayed in Nairobi. He was trying to get a business going. If Fadumo got refugee status, he could travel to Europe too. For Mohammed, sending his wife and family to Europe was like insurance. If things didn't work out in Nairobi, then as a last resort, he could join them there. A week after Fadumo left, she sent word that she was in a camp in Holland. It didn't sound that attractive, a camp. Months later, Mahmoud also left. He moved to Abu Dhabi with Saido to set up a business. These people had lost everything, relatives, property, businesses, social lives, plans for the future, but they were prepared to start from scratch in foreign countries. I didn't think of any part of this as cheating. I admired their resilience. A few months after Marian Farah came to Nairobi, Abe decided to marry her again. He would move out of our Park Road apartment to live with Marian, Ichabo, and Arro. I suppose that when Marian found out that Ma never said a word to him, she proposed the move. It made so much sense. When the decision was made, Abe called Mahat, Hawea, and me together and told us about it. He asked for our blessing, and we gave it, though of course we declined to be present at the wedding ceremony. I know that Hawea and Mahat were resentful of his decision, but although I was not exactly glad, I wanted Abe to be happy. Marian and Abe rented a small house in Buruburu. Abe told me I could visit them anytime. He even proposed that I live with them. That was nonsense, of course. I could never have abandoned my mother to live with another of my father's consorts. When my father moved out, Ma showed no emotion. She just said, "Well, the storeroom's empty now, and we put the stuff back in it again." She was dry and hard, but inside, I knew it was killing her. All the years of living alone, sleeping alone, the emotional abandonment, and now again, the public rejection. Ma became hostile and spoke to me in the ugliest kind of way. She began to beat me again. I think perhaps my mother went a little mad at one point. She had once seized control of her life in Aden, and then she somehow lost it. Now she found herself in a country where she didn't want to be, with no self left at all. She was marooned. I think that was what made her so angry. One Friday afternoon, at the end of January 1992, my father came straight from the mosque to our flat. He never did that, never paid us a visit these days, and when he arrived, he was completely excited. "Ayan, my daughter, I have good news for you, the best news. My prayers are answered," he crowed. "Today in the mosque, a blessed man came to me with a proposal of marriage, and I offered him your hand." I remember letting him talk while I felt my heels sinking into the ground. I cleared my throat and said no, but he didn't hear me. I said I'm not going to marry a stranger. And my father, bubbling with enthusiasm, answered, "But he's not a stranger. He's not a stranger at all. He's your cousin. He's an Osman Mahmoud." He began chanting back all of this man's names. I said, not a stranger in that sense, Abe. And he answered, in what sense then? But I haven't even met him, I wailed. My father told me, that's fine, you'll meet him tomorrow. My father had given me away to a man called Osman Musa, a fine young Somali man who had grown up in Canada. He had come to Nairobi to find and rescue family members who had been stranded by the civil war, and also to find a bride. He thought the Somali girls in Canada were too westernized, by which he meant that they dressed indecently, disobeyed their husbands, and mixed freely with men. They were not bari, which made them unworthy of marriage. And the civil war meant that daughters of the best families in Somalia were available for practically nothing. My father had met this young man in the mosque barely 2 hours before. He was tall, he told me, with strong bones and white teeth, well fed on milk and meat in North America. Osman Musa must have approached him. I can imagine the scene, the respectful recitation of lineage. Finally, the request. You are the father of daughters, and I seek a bride. My father must have felt so very happy. Aro was older than I, so my father should really have offered her, but he didn't. My father chose me, his devout, dutiful, deserving daughter, Ayan. He offered me to this good fortune, and Osman Musa accepted me. And the two of them paraded around the mosque, announcing their marvelous, God-given march to all the elders of the clan. It never even occurred to them to ask me what I thought. There was no bride price. Because of the civil war, it would have been indecent to ask for one. But this was a strategic marriage. Osman Musa could boast that he was married to a Magan, and we would now have relatives in Canada. There were all kinds of reasons for my father to be happy about this match. I summoned the strength to say to my father, Abe, what if I am already with some other person? But he wasn't even listening. He said, Allah has sent us the answer. He was overcome with his own cleverness. After Abe left, still bubbling with joy, I went and told Ma about it. She just said, oh, now we are father enough to take responsibility for our daughters' marriages, are we? Fine. Nothing more. I was in a panic, but I wasn't crying. I rarely cried in those days. I could just see very clearly and dispassionately the bars closing in on me. The next day, my father came to the house with Osman Musa. The living room was clean, and everyone was excited except me. I just wore normal clothes, a loose dress and headscarf. I wasn't going to dress up for this. This man came in. He wanted to shake my hand. He was very tall and wore enormously long blue jeans. He looked like a basketball player with a shaved head and a baseball cap. I was polite. I said, hello, come in, I'm Ayan, without looking him in the eye, and fetched my mother. My father and mother both remained in the room with us. Ma and I sat on the bed, and this man talked about Canada, where he had lived since he was a small boy, and about the refugees and the war. We didn't make eye contact. Osman Musa was talking with my mother, trying to pass master. When I could look up, I scrutinized him, the way he talked, his face, thinking, will I like this man? I was supposed to make a home and a life with him, cook, bear his kids, respond to his whims. What did I know of him? His Somali was poor, half learned. He seemed earnest. A good believing Muslim would pray to Allah for guidance, wisdom, strength, but I didn't. I felt this was for me to sort out. I found myself thinking about the one night I had spent with Mahmoud and imagining this Osman Musa in that light. Did I want to go to bed with this man? I couldn't ask Allah to do anything to help me decide about that. Kennedy had been generous and tender. There was a spark of connection between us. We shared things. He had seen me scrubbing floors and washing socks, and in every situation he liked me and respected me. Even with Abshir, who was so cramped up about rules, there was an attraction between us. But this Osman Musa was a total stranger. He neither repelled nor attracted me. I felt indifferent, completely without feeling. I didn't detect that he had any special interest in me either. The marriage was set for Saturday, 6 days away. Our second meeting was more intimate. Osman Musa and his sister came, and I asked Hawea and Mahat to be with me, to help me evaluate this man. Ma left us five young people alone. I asked about prayer. I wanted to find out how religious this Osman Musa was. I felt I had to make some sort of decision fast, even though there seemed to be no way I could stop the arrangement from proceeding. He clearly had brotherhood leanings, but was not quite as devout as Ichabu, judging by his clothes. He wore jeans and a baseball cap. But although he was less stalwart in his devotion, he seemed even more concerned than Ichabu about policing the piety of others. I asked, "What do you expect of a wife?" Osman's sister was mortified and said, "Maybe we shouldn't be here if you're going to discuss such things." But Osman Musa barely laughed and said, "You're going to give me six sons. We will be a home for all the Osman Mahamud." He went on and on about how Somali girls who grew up in Canada, as he had, were all practically whores, drinking alcohol, going to discos, not covering themselves and sleeping with white men. They were out of control. He would never choose one to be the mother of his children. For the mother of his six sons, this man needed someone like me, who dressed like me, who was dutiful, irreproachable, and the daughter of such a devout man, the marvelous Hirsi Magan. We grilled him subtly in the Somali epics we had learned from our mother, some of them composed by the Abdi Halim brothers' great-grandfather. To our eternal wonder, he knew none of them. Worse still, instead of admitting his ignorance, he pretended he knew what we were talking about, which made him seem small. We asked him grandma's old riddles. He failed them. We switched to English. We assumed this man's English must be better than his limping Somali, and Hawea asked him what kind of books he read. He said, "I read, you know, stuff." I realized that his English was half-learned too, and he clearly read nothing at all. I summoned enough courage to ask him to take off his baseball cap, which he did. I thought perhaps I might fall in love with his head of hair or something. But though Osman was only 27 years old, his head was already as bald as the bottom of baby Abbas. Baldness is associated with wisdom among Somalis, but this man had nothing to show for losing so much hair at such an early age. Mahat brought up politics. All kinds of talk was going on about peace then. He asked, "So when we all go back to Somalia, what would you contribute?" Osman Musa said, "I'll obviously have a place in government. I have lived outside the country, and I am an Osman Mahamud. The only solution for Somalia is for the Osman Mahamud to rule. We are the only people with experience governing." The three of us didn't even have to discuss it. The man was an idiot. He thought the Osman Mahamud were the chosen people. He was dull, trite, and a bigot, a dyed-in-the-wool brotherhood type. I remember thinking, "No, surely Abu could not do this to me." When Osman Musa finally left, I tried to pull together the courage to take matters into my own hands. I put on my coat and went to Buruburu, where my father was living. When he opened the door, I said, "Osman Musa came to our house today, and Hawea and Mahad and I tested him. We think he's a pea brain. He's not eloquent. He's not brave enough to admit his shortcomings, and he's a bigot." Just like that. That way, my father couldn't ignore what I was saying, as he mostly did. He had me come and sit down and said, "Now tell me." "I don't think this man and I are compatible," I said. He said, smiling broadly, "On the basis of one afternoon?" I told my father, "You thought on the basis of 1 minute that we would be compatible. So I think on the basis of one afternoon that we are not. But Abe said, no, I know more than that. He is the son of the son of the son. He quoted the lineage. He has a good job in Canada. He doesn't chew cud. He's clean and a conscientious worker. He's strong. I am giving you to him to ensure your safety. He went on. The ceremony will be Saturday at Farah Gura's house. The sheep have been bought. The Qali has been hired. You are saying you don't want this is not a question. We are living in bad times. Surely you won't reject my choice of a husband for you just because he doesn't read novels? He reduced it to the smallest thing. Imagine how trivial my opposition would sound to Abe if I added, but he has no hair. Still, I sat up straight and told him, I'm not going to do it. My father said, I can't accept a no from you for something you haven't even tried. I asked, you mean I can't say no before I get married? He answered, of course not. Everything is all arranged. Nobody tied me up. I was not shackled. I was not forced at gunpoint. But I had no realistic way out. In Islam, the nikah ceremony is the moment when you become legally bound to your spouse. A marriage contract is signed, but it's not always followed immediately by consummation. The night of defloration usually follows a party that ends in the house that husband and wife will share. My father decided that my nikah on Saturday would not have to be followed immediately by a wedding party or a wedding night. We could celebrate that with Osman Musa's family in Canada. He came to Ma's house the next day to tell me so. The nikah will be on Saturday, but you can have another gathering in Canada for the wedding night. This way, you'll have the whole of next week to get to know each other before Osman leaves, he told me cheerfully. And once he's gone, you can write each other letters or you can talk on the phone. See? There's ample opportunity for the two of you to get to know each other. I was called to my father. I told him I'm not coming to the nikah, and all he said was, you're not required. Legally, that is true. By now, my father was the center of attention. What a match he had made. What a piece of good news in these hard times. He was impatient with what he saw as my bleating. As if all this were not enough drama for our household, on the next afternoon, Tuesday, Ali Warsengeli, the cousin who had officiated as guardian at my wedding ceremony with Mahmoud barely 18 months ago, blew into our doorway in a righteous rage. He had heard about my coming nuptials with Osman Musa and had come to assert Mahmoud's property rights over my person. When Ma came to the door, Ali told her I had married Uncle Muhammad's son, Mahmoud. He said, Hirsi Magan must learn of it. The wedding must be stopped. Luckily, Mahad was home and he broke in. What marriage is this? He blustered. This can't be true. Who was the guardian? I wasn't present, and neither was her father. There was no marriage. My mother collected herself. She was completely composed, as she always was, in public. Who was the guardian at this supposed ceremony? She inquired haughtily. I was, Ali admitted. You had no right to act as guardian, Mahat interjected, his voice raised. I was in Mogadishu. Did you call me? Did you call her father? You could have come and fetched me. Why didn't you? It doesn't matter, Ali said. The marriage took place. Do you have proof of any such ceremony? Do you have a paper? Ali had none. They talked. When Ali said he was leaving, my mother didn't beg him to stay as required by etiquette. There will be no gossiping about my children, she told him firmly. Mahat turned on me as soon as Ali had left. Where is the certificate, he demanded. There was no point denying what had happened. I admitted to everything, or almost everything. I didn't mention the night in the hotel, but I said I had married Mahmoud in Mogadishu the night before he left for Russia, and that he had later fallen for a Finnish girl whom he planned to marry. I went to get the photos she had sent me and her letter. So you see, Mahmoud wants to forget about it, and I wrote that that was fine. I ended lamely. It was a mistake. I produced the paper from the Qali that Ali Warsengeli had given me in Mogadishu. Mahat grabbed it suspiciously. This is not a legal document. It's rubbish, he announced. There is no valid guardian. He tore it up, scattering the pieces on the floor, and launched into a tirade about my irresponsibility. My mother barely said anything. I knew she was incensed, but above all, she was relieved that my marriage to Mahmoud was invalid. In an immediate sense, she was concerned only with figuring out a way to spare her family from scandal. Mahat's goal in life now became preventing Ali Warsengeli from intervening before the nikah, which was 4 days away. First, he went to my father and told him that a maternal cousin of ours had arrived in Nairobi, an evil-minded man who was spreading all sorts of groundless rumors about Ayan out of sheer spite. Abe, of course, was revolted that such terrible people could exist in this world. Then Mahat found out where Ali Warsengeli was staying and went to see him. He told him my nikah was scheduled in 10 days' time and promised to take him to consult with my father the following week. By then, it would be too late. I would be married. The day of my wedding, I did what I always did every day. I dressed normally and did my chores. I was in denial. I knew that over at Farah Gura's house, there was a Qali registering my union with Osman Muse before my father and Mahat and a crowd of other men. Afterward, there would be a big lunch with roasted sheep for men only. I would not be present. Neither my presence nor my signature was required for the Islamic ceremony. I made lunch at home, and after lunch, I went out with Hawea. We walked to the Arboretum and talked about the mess life had suddenly become in the past 8 days. After the nikah, my new husband and I had a week together to know each other. I went with him to Uhuru Park. I met his friends. He talked about his life when he was young, his dreams. It was also nondescript. I've almost deleted it from my mind. We talked a lot about religion. Osman Muse was very devoted to Islam and to the good name of his family. He said Somalia was in a civil war because we had left the way of Allah. He talked again about Somali girls in Canada and their loose morals. He never made a carnal gesture toward me because he respected me as my father's daughter and his own distant cousin. We would wait for the wedding party in Canada. When we were alone together, I felt completely frozen. I couldn't even imagine wanting to go to bed with this man or waking up every morning beside him. Not everything was traditional. No mother-in-law inspected my virginity. We were above that undignified procedure. It was all a sure thing. I met his friends and behaved properly as the daughter of Hirsi Magan should, wearing my black hijab, of which they thoroughly approved. We all made small talk about the war and current events. I concentrated on behaving properly, speaking softly, being polite, avoiding shame to my parents. I felt empty. When Osman's friends got angry, it wasn't about people cheating or lying, but about women who didn't wear the headscarf, or men who didn't pray often enough. I recognized the attitude from Ichabo. It was beginning to irritate me more and more. I accompanied Osman to the airport after 6 days when he returned to Toronto. He would expedite the visa papers as soon as possible, and I would fly to meet him there as soon as I could. That was the plan. At the airport, he gave me a hug and said, "Look forward to seeing you." I nodded solemnly and said, "Travel safely," and edged out of his embrace. I was aware of being cold, and I felt sorry for it, but I could do no better. Ali Warsengeli did eventually go to see my father. Abe closed the door in his face, then came to see me in Park Road. He was always popping by these days with papers to sign and visas to discuss, ebullient with his own cleverness and energized by the new task of preparing my journey. "I hear stories of you and Mahmud, the son of your mother's brother," he said to me. "What is the truth of this?" I told him, "Nothing." So my father went away again, singing. He was always happy these days. Ali Wersengeli didn't have much of a story, it turned out. There was no proof of any wedding ceremony between me and Mahmud. Mahat had torn up my paper, and Mahmud himself conspicuously failed to assert his so-called conjugal claim over me. Most people swiftly concluded that it was all just as Mahat had said, a spiteful rumor. Nobody wanted anything to go wrong for Ayan Hersi Magan. Amid all the depressing news and chaos of the civil war in Somalia, I was a symbol of hope, a pious, obedient girl who deserved the marvelous match that her father had made. A Qali is a recognized marriage official, and weeks after the nikah, my father took the marriage certificate drawn up by the Qali and officially registered my wedding with the Kenyan Marriage Bureau. I knew this because one day in June, he brought me home an official Kenyan government document written in English and Arabic with a special box to indicate whether virgin or not and the amount of dowry. The boxes were all filled in for me. The answers were virgin and 10 books of Holy Quran. And the document also indicated that I had been represented at my wedding in February by my father. My father told me I must now sign this Kenyan document. I hesitated, but I was already married to Osman Muse in the eyes of Islam and every Muslim I knew. What difference could it possibly make if I signed, I thought. So right under my father's signature in Arabic, I signed it. A.H. Magan. Abe worked hard to get me travel documents from the UNHCR office. Within weeks, he had my passport. Then he went after a visa. Every few days, he spoke on the phone with Osman Muse about it. The Canadian embassy in Nairobi was crowded with Somalis trying to emigrate, and it seemed impossible to get anything done in the corruption and chaos of the Kenyan bureaucracy. My father ended up enlisting the help of a relative living in Düsseldorf whose name was Mursal, and together they decided I should go to Germany to wait for the final visa to come in. It would be quicker that way, and more practical. My father began calling me to his house in Buruburu for what amounted to a series of extra lectures in Islam and how to be a good wife. We spent several mornings taking up chapters of the Quran on the duties of a wife and formally discussing them. For example, her duty to ask permission to leave the house. My father told me, "You can do the following. You can agree together early on that permission is permanently given. That is a form of trust, his trust in you, so you don't have to ask permission every time you go out for groceries. There is a Quranic injunction to women to be sexually available to their husbands at all times." My father didn't go into the details, but he read it. "Your wives are your tillage. Go in unto your tillage, in what manner soever you will," he said. "You must always be there for your husband, in bed and outside it. Don't make your husband beg. Don't refuse him. Don't make him look elsewhere. This is also a kind of permission you give from the onset. You're always available. He can't abuse that because he's from a good family. Force and rape are not an issue because he's a believing Muslim and he's an Osman Mahmud." We talked about living as a Muslim in the West. Having unbelievers as friends was a grey area. My father said, "It's discouraged, but if you can make good, honest friendships with infidels, so long as you don't follow their ways, then such relationships are not forbidden." We went into what you are supposed to teach children. There is one God, no jinns, no saints, no magic, no intercession. Asking help from a spirit or jinn is forbidden. It puts other beings on a level with Allah. In everything you do, ask yourself, what would the Prophet do? Some things are clearly permitted and others clearly forbidden. But in grey areas, my father said, the Prophet was liberal. He would never make anything obligatory if it harmed you. There is no coercion in Islam, my father said. No human being has the right to punish another for not observing his religious duties. Only Allah can do that. It was like Quran school, but more intelligent. We even talked about martyrdom. My father said that committing suicide for holy war was acceptable only in the time of the Prophet, and then only because the unbelievers had attacked the Prophet first. Today, there could not be a holy war, he said, because only the Prophet Muhammad could call for a holy war. This was my father's Islam, a mostly non-violent religion that was his own interpretation of the Prophet's words. It relied on one's own sense of right and wrong, at least to some degree. It was more intelligent than the Islam I had learned from the Ma'alim, and it was also far more humane. Still, this version of Islam also left me with unanswered questions and a sense of injustice. Why was it that only women needed to ask permission from their husband to leave the house and not the other way around? My father's Islam was also clearly an interpretation of what the Prophet said. As such, it was not legitimate. You may not interpret the will of Allah and the words of the Quran. It says so right there in the book. There is a read-only lock. It's forbidden to pick and choose. You may only obey. The Prophet said, I have left you with clear guidance. No one deviates from it after me, except that he shall be destroyed. A fundamentalist would tell my father, the sentence, only the Prophet can call a holy war, is not in the Quran. You are putting it in there. That is blasphemy. Osman Musa paid for all my travel arrangements because I was now his. There are rules about these things. You pay for your wife. I did the rounds, bade goodbye to everyone, Halwa and Aynashe and Farah Gura's family. They were now my close cousins because they were my husband's relatives too. I said goodbye to my father the night before I was due to leave. He embraced me and said we might not see each other again for a very long time. When we depart, we may intend to return, he told me, but many things might prevent us from doing so. I eyed him skeptically. I knew that he was speaking from experience. The day of my departure, Ma overheard Hawea and me talking about what to do. Hawea thought the best plan would be to divorce Osman Musa as soon as possible once I was in Canada. Once I was divorced, I could travel to America, she said, and live my own life. She spun a whole romantic story for me. Then Ma burst in and said we were immoral. She said I was a slut and a hypocrite who had destroyed her relationship with her own brother and would wreck the honor of her family and my father's. She said, there are two conditions if you want me to say goodbye to you and wish you well. The first one is that you promise to stay married to Osman Musa. You will be a good wife to him and pray to Allah and be grateful for the destiny your father has made for you. And the second is that you go to your father and tell him everything. I told myself that my mother was right. I should just go to Abe and tell him everything. That way, maybe he would find me a way out. So I put my headscarf on and went to see him again. I said, Abe, I have something to tell you. And he greeted me with his arms outstretched once again. Ah, Ayan, my beloved daughter has visited me again. I said, I have something to confess about mother's brother Muhammad and his son Mahmoud. Abe said loudly, but we dealt with that, didn't we? It's all done, child. Are you worried about your dear old father? My darling, you should be off preparing your departure. He kept overflowing with words, and my tongue stuck in my throat. I think he may have known that what I wanted to tell him was unwelcome. So I went back home and I told my mother the whole scene. She ordered me to go right back to Buruburu and say it all anyway. I said, I will miss the plane. And she said, then promise me in the name of Allah that you will stay with this man, your husband. I said, no. I told her I wouldn't promise that. So my mother didn't bid me farewell. I said goodbye to her stiff back. Then I left in a taxi for the airport. Part 2. My freedom. Chapter 10. Running away. When we landed at the Frankfurt airport early in the morning, I was dazed by the scale of it. Everything around me was glass and steel, and also finished, down to the last little fixture. That impressed me. Where I came from, airports were chaos, constantly expanding, always half-built. And everyone around me seemed so sure of where they were headed. There were women as old as my mother, even my grandmother, with fashionable handbags, pushing trolleys full of matching suitcases with energy and purpose. I was lost. I was looking for the ticket office. I knew I was supposed to be going to Düsseldorf, but my ticket said Munich, so I knew I must somehow get it changed. I went wandering about, navigating by asking people for help. I didn't even notice the signage. The airport was as big as a neighborhood, and all of it looked the same. I felt hapless, like a country yokel from the Mie. My distant uncle, Mursal, had agreed to look after me in Germany while I was waiting for my visa. I had never met him. When I finally got to Düsseldorf, I changed some dollars to Deutschmarks, figured out which was the right coin, and phoned the number Mursal had given my father. Another man answered the phone. He was Umar, Mursal's associate. He said, so, you're Hirsimagan's daughter. Can you write down an address and give it to the driver of a taxi? I said yes, took the address down, and stepped outside. Everything was so clean, it was like a movie. The roads, the pavement, the people. Nothing in my life had ever looked like this, except perhaps Nairobi Hospital. It was so modern, it seemed sterile. The landscape looked like geometry class or physics, where everything was in straight lines and had to be perfect and precise. These buildings were cubes and triangles, and they gave me that same neutral, almost frightening feeling. The letters on the signs resembled English, but I couldn't understand them. It felt like trying to make sense of algebra. My grandmother must have felt this way when she went to a city for the first time and saw a light bulb, a radio, a whole road full of cars. I felt that foreign. There was a line for taxis. The word was in English, but all the taxis were cream Mercedes. In Nairobi, such taxis would line up only at fancy hotels. They were the most luxurious option conceivable, really only for foreigners and government ministers. Before I got into such a car, I felt I must ask the driver how much money the ride would cost. He said about 20 marks, which I could pay. I asked, but will you drive me in this car? And the driver laughed. He was nice and spoke English. I sat in the front beside him, and he told me all about Düsseldorf and how good and kind the German people were. The old city of Düsseldorf was indeed wonderful. Its church spires and angled towers, a bit like minarets. The streets were cobbled. They looked as if made for humans, unlike the scary, ultra-modern airport. The taxi dropped me off, and I was met by Umar, a tall, easygoing man with a moustache, wearing a grey suit and no tie. He said I was amazing. Nobody ever made it all the way from the airport so easily, and to have changed planes in Frankfurt too. I was a prodigy. You'll be fine here, he told me. Most Somalis call in the middle of the night and say, please come and get me. When I say, where are you? They tell me, I'm standing next to a tall building. They are useless. Omar wasn't troubled by the fact that my luggage hadn't arrived with me. He said that in Germany such things never got lost. My uncle was detained by business and would meet me later, so Omar took me to a hotel in the old city. He said he would be back at 8 to take me to dinner. Everything in the room was white and pristine. I examined the duvet, vowing to tell Hawea about this amazing invention. The room was small, but all somehow cleverly planned to fit. The closets fit into the wall, the television inside a cabinet. How cool, I thought. The bathroom was another revelation. We had a shower in Park Road, but it never had hot water, so we boiled water and used a pail and a scoop. Here was hot water, tons of it, in different jets, from above and from the sides. I washed. It was still light outside, so I decided to go out. I had to see more of this place. I wrote down the name of the hotel. I knew I would get lost. Pulled on my headscarf and long coat and walked into the street. I had never seen so many white people. The women were bare. They seemed naked. Their legs, their whole arms.